Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And a welcome, everyone, to the Monday President's Day edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity of National Review is honoring Franklin Pierce today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, giving a shout-out to Andrew Johnson because it's President's Day. It's not Washington's birthday anymore. It's not Lincoln's birthday. It's all presidents, so they're all equally great, Jim.
Oh, you know, Chester A. Arthur, John Tyler, Charles Logan, you know, one great one after another.
Charles Logan, very well done. All right, good, bad, crazy martinis for conservatives as usual, and we start with a mini debate. I think we're mostly in agreement on this. The question now of Hillary Clinton running for president in 2016, is it a good idea for conservatives like Rand Paul to bring up, in light of the Democratic theme continually of the war on women, of Bill Clinton's conduct during his time in the White House, particularly his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, the allegations made by Kathleen Willey, and on and on and on and on. Mitt Romney, of course, the standard bearer for the Republicans in 2012, was on Meet the Press on Sunday talking with David Gregory. Here's a couple of clips about how Mitt Romney looks at how Republicans ought to view this race.
Well, I don't think Bill Clinton is as relevant as Hillary Clinton if Hillary Clinton decides to run for president. And in her case, I think people will look at her record as the Secretary of State and say, during that period of time, did our relations with nations around the world elevate America and elevate our interests, or were they receding? And I think her record is what will be judged upon, not the record of her husband. The times when he was president were, by and large, positive economic times for the country. On the other hand, he embarrassed the nation. He breached his responsibility, I think, as an adult and as a leader in his relationship. And I think that's very unfortunate. But I don't think that's Hillary Clinton's to explain.
And so, Jim, I think it is right for history and a lot of other people to determine that Bill Clinton's behavior, morally speaking, in the White House and in other ways, was absolutely reprehensible. The question, I think, for conservatives now, and Rand Paul certainly has been talking about that, is whether that should be a major part of the campaign against Hillary Clinton, assuming she's the nominee. I think it's perhaps important, depending on how she characterizes her campaign. If she goes with this war on women theme, that could be an effective counter, perhaps. But keep in mind that most people not only opposed impeachment at the time, since the economy was pretty good, as Mitt Romney indicated, but a lot of people see Hillary as the victim here. So bringing that up, I'm not sure brings down Hillary much. What say you?
Yeah, I think you put it exactly, meaning that if Democrats are going to decide to make war on women their big theme for the midterms and beyond, then it's worth mentioning that this is a party who has been more than willing to turn a blind eye to what some people would say is abusive behavior or just flat-out bad behavior, part of Bill Clinton and other presidents before then. And, you know, it's one of those things where when making this critique, the likes of Rand Paul, I have to make very clear that this is a critique of Democrats as a whole, not of Hillary Clinton, because, you know, whatever Hillary Clinton's flaws, it's not like she drove Bill Clinton into the arms of Monica Lewinsky. That's on Bill Clinton. So this is a little bit, I suspect, of Rand Paul trying to toxify Bill Clinton before the midterms, make him a less useful person to have on the campaign trail as a surrogate and going around doing fundraisers and things like that for the Senate Democrats and House Democrats. As long as Rand Paul can strike that balance that Romney, you know, articulated pretty well there, it should work pretty well. But if it goes too far, they'll be quick to play the victim card. And I don't, you know, for all of Hillary Clinton's flaws, I don't think Americans really blame her that much for what happened in the Lewinsky scandal.
No, and it is tough because Republicans were accused. I don't know if I would say rightly so. In many cases, I don't think rightly so. They were accused of overplaying their hand against Bill Clinton in 1998 and early 1999. At the same time, though, without that scandal, it's hard to see necessarily how George W. Bush wins in 2000. He certainly made restoring honor and dignity to the Oval Office a major theme of that campaign. And I don't think you can argue that the scandal hurt Al Gore more than anybody who had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, one of the intriguing things about this is by bringing this up, does Rand Paul kind of say, do you really want to get back into this again? Do you really want these into your lives? The psychodrama, the constant soap opera of this marriage dominating national headlines. And does that seem like something maybe we could accept during a time of seeming peace and prosperity of the late 1990s, but maybe, you know, more of a distraction and more of a frustration during a period of not peace and definitely not prosperity, which is what we're likely to have for the foreseeable future. You know, so this is a kind of a complicated three-level chess strategy on the part of Rand Paul. It could work or it could very well backfire. I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But as long as he's careful about it, it should work. That would make it a good martini.
Yeah, all right. Well, on to the bad martini now, and this is courtesy of Jim Garrity over at the campaign spot of National Review. Jim, you've taken a quick look at some of the highest political donors in recent years, and it turns out there's a pretty consistent theme. And no, it's not the Koch brothers leading the list here, but it's about who gives the most amount of money and where does it go. You have the organization, you have the amount, and you have the tilt. The time frame here is from 1989 through 2012. I'm not familiar with Act Blue, but they've spent nearly $100 million over those 24 years or so. Leans heavily Democratic. The big thing here is the amazing presence of organized labor high on this list. American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, number two. Number four, National Education Association. Number seven, Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. United Auto Workers, eight. Nine, Carpenters and Joiners Union. 10, Service Employees International Union. Laborers Union. American Federation of Teachers. Communication Workers. Teamsters. That's all in the top 15. And as you point out, the number one donor that tilts Republican, UPS.
When next time you see those guys in brown delivering a package, give them a thumbs up and tell them thanks for the support for conservative. Okay, so here's the irony of looking at this list. Act Blue, by the way, is a kind of a clearinghouse for donations. They basically organized, or you know, grew out of the Netroots movement back in the middle of the Bush years and have generated $97 million in donations to Democrats, 99% going to Democrats. What you get from this is that most unions are overwhelmingly donate to Democrats, which is not surprising. Businesses are a little more even, wanting to stay on good terms of both. Yeah, you know, I've heard some people argue that because AT&T gave 57% of their donations to Republicans, they really should be considered a Republican group. Well, for whatever reason, Open Secrets decided the threshold for being a tilting to one party or another is 60%. That's what it requires to be considered that. The realtors split roughly evenly. Goldman Sachs gives us about 53% to Democrats, 44% to Republicans. Other donations are going to go to either nonpartisan offices or independent candidates or things like that. You add them all up, and you have to go pretty far down the list before you get to a Republican. As you mentioned, that's UPS, way down at 17th place. And even that still is giving 35% of their donations to Democrats. So you got to go really, the Koch brothers, kind of the infamous group that constantly gets mentioned as the villains of campaign finance stories, they're way down around 59th or so. So because this goes back to 1989, one of the things this indicates is how much unions had got up on the, got a head start on in terms of political activism. Some of these groups, like Microsoft, weren't really doing much back in 1989. Some of them are, you know, didn't even exist. Other ones are just kind of slowly rising. But you look at this chart and you begin to realize the story of which is basically, you know, our adult lives, Greg, is that Democrats wanted it more and were willing to pay more. Now, some of this comes from willing to put more resources into winning these elections. Now, some of this comes from unions. When you're able to force lots of people to give money to your organization, which you can then turn around and spend on helping the candidates you support, you have a very big advantage. You look at this chart and you begin to realize it's kind of amazing that Republicans have managed to win the races they have, considering how many of the top 25 organizations are considered either heavily Democratic or on the fence. I think only three of the top 25 count as considered Republican-leaning, and yet that still means that they're giving about 60-some percent to Republicans and 30-some are still going to Democrats.
Good job digging that up, and you're also all over the place with this crazy martini today, and that's the story of your good friend John Kerry. He is in Asia right now. He's speaking in Indonesia. We apologize for the quality of this audio, but here's how John Kerry characterized the threat of climate change with no hyperbole whatsoever.
When I think about the array of global climate of global threats, think about this. Terrorism, epidemics, poverty, the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. All challenges that know no borders. The reality is that climate change ranks right up there with every single one of them.
We can certainly debate that. But Jim, you've pointed out that just on this trip alone, for a Secretary of State so concerned about climate change, he's racked up over two-thirds of the metric tons of carbon dioxide that the typical American uses in a year. It's also found out that John Kerry is blaming climate change on the volcano ash that prevented him from meeting with the Indonesian president yesterday. So once again, no matter what goes wrong, I guess we can blame it on human activity and the climate.
You know, of course, Greg, because as we all know, before the increased amount of carbon emissions and greenhouse gases, before industry came along, there was no such thing as a volcanic eruption. So that is literally Gaia spitting at us to show how much he disapproves of you and your Big Mac and your SUV and stuff like that. Well, a couple things that kind of jump out at this. I think it was Glenn Reynolds over at Instapundit who said, I'll believe it's a crisis when the people who are telling me that it's a crisis start acting like it's a crisis. When they tell us, well, we have to reduce our carbon emissions, they seem to be telling us that we shouldn't be buying SUVs anymore, even though John Kerry travels everywhere in an SUV with a little motorcade and all that stuff. And we're told, well, we can't have big houses anymore. And of course, you know, Al Gore has that huge house, which has the single highest electric bill of anyone in the state of Tennessee. And then the other thing, apparently the single biggest thing that you can do to contribute to greenhouse gas emissions is flying in a jet. And, you know, they have a system over there. They have online calculators that calculate how much carbon gets emitted, depending on whether you're, you know, flying in coach class, business class, or first class. Well, John Kerry gets his own plane. So they don't really have an option to say, when you measure the carbon emissions of the Secretary of State's plane. So I just use first class ticket equivalent. And I went through his itinerary for this trip, which is a, you know, round-the-world trip. Seoul, South Korea, Beijing, China, Jakarta, Indonesia, Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates, and then back to Washington. You add it all up, and just from the flying, never mind taking the car everywhere, he generates about 12 metric tons of carbon dioxide. Now, that seems like a lot. It's because it is. You, average American listening to this, generate about 19 tons of carbon dioxide in a year. So in about 6 days, he's going to do what takes you 7 months to do. What's kind of just mind-boggling about this is that John Kerry has no problem going and giving these speeches and saying this is the biggest crisis in the whole wide world. And this biggest crisis in the whole wide world requires everybody else to make sacrifices. It makes everybody else has to change their behavior. Everybody else has to give up the luxuries that they're used to in life, be it, you know, cars or big houses or thermostats or anything like that. But he himself doesn't have to do anything. We haven't even gotten into the cost of heating all of his houses that he and Teresa Hines Carey have and stuff like that. So I remember doing this back for Thomas Friedman, another big advocate of this stuff. I've not been able to find any evidence that the State Department purchases carbon offsets to offset all of these carbon emissions. So just the hypocrisy here is rather astounding. You begin to realize that, look, if these guys aren't willing to make any sacrifices on their part in order to reduce this, but they insist it's a priority, why should the rest of us? So that's what makes it, in my eyes, the crazy martini of the day, Greg.
That was an absolutely crazy martini. The good news is that they're probably all wet on all of this, so it doesn't really matter. But the hypocrisy is real. So, you know, we got that going for us, which is
and
nice.
And the effort to restrict our choices and regulate our lives is real, yeah. So
yes.
Even then, it's kind of nice to take this and throw this in their faces. What it really comes down to is that, look, they're the elites. They're the special people. They don't have to live by the rules the rest of us do. And, this is a way of formalizing an aristocracy of the global elites over the rest of us. So, you know, because they're special, they get to use as much carbon as they like.
All right, Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And please join us again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.